I think the audio recording is really the key to this whole case in many ways, because it strips away a lot of the he said, she said of this case.
What happened and what mattered in the third week of former President Trump's criminal trial. For Saturday, May 4th, it's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow. Ahead, what comes next for Israel's embattled prime minister as the country's war in Gaza drags on? And a look at an issue that has become a flashpoint in politics, places where non-citizens can vote in local elections.
We are a nation of immigrants, so it's wild to imagine how we got to this place where we have to worry about these things.
And it's Derby Day. We'll talk to a longtime trainer who has a horse in the Kentucky Derby for the first time. We will also meet the new world record holder for running a mile pushing a stroller.
Didn't expect that this was ever going to be on the radar, but it's turned out to be a really fun experience.
First News.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Janine Herbst. A delegation of the Hamas militant group has arrived in Cairo to discuss the latest proposal to end the war in Gaza, according to Egyptian state media. NPR's Lauren Freer reports after a number of failed attempts, international negotiators say there are signs of a potential compromise for a ceasefire.
Hamas says its delegation is going to, quote, complete the talks with a positive spirit. On a trip to the region this past week, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken blamed Hamas for delays in a deal. The impasse appears to hinge on whether a ceasefire would be temporary or permanent, and whether Israeli troops would fully withdraw from the Gaza Strip. Meanwhile, Cindy McCain, the American director of the UN World Food Program, says northern Gaza is now in full-blown famine. In an interview scheduled to air Sunday on NBC's Meet the Press, she says a ceasefire and increased aid are essential to confront a humanitarian catastrophe for more than 2 million people in Gaza. Lauren Freier, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
Former President Donald Trump is attending the Republican National Committee's spring retreat in Florida this weekend. NPR's Jang Yoon Han has more.
Trump will host events at Mar-a-Lago for part of the retreat. The weekend is expected to include a high-profile roster of possible VP picks. Republican Senators Marco Rubio of Florida, J.D. Vance of Ohio, and Tim Scott of South Carolina are billed as special guests. North Dakota Governor Doug Burgum, along with his South Dakota counterpart Kristi Noem, are also expected to attend. And New York House Representative Elise Stefanik is on the guest list. Trump said earlier this year he's considering a short list of around 15 names to be his running mate, but he's also maintained he'll announce his running mate closer to the GOP convention in Milwaukee in mid-July. Jang Yoon Han, NPR News.
The Houston area is still under a flood watch, with more rain on the way after major flooding in some areas. Jack Williams from Houston Public Media has more.
Most of Houston is okay, but areas to the northeast of the city have been hit hard by heavy rain over the past few days. The San Jacinto River continues to rise near some populated areas, but in other areas the water has receded. Harris County Judge Lena Hidalgo says more heavy rain is expected.
If we get 1 to 3 inches, we'd be fine. If we get 4, 5, 6, might be okay. But if the weather pattern slows down, it keeps forming over and over again, kind of like what has been happening, then we'll be in trouble.
Hidalgo says as of Saturday afternoon, nearly 200 people have been rescued from high water in Harris County. But so far, there have been no deaths or major injuries reported. For NPR News, I'm Jack Williams in Houston.
And you're listening to NPR News in Washington.
This is 90.9 WBUR. I'm Susan Levy in Boston. Northeastern University and Wheaton College are holding their commencements tomorrow. Northeastern's ceremony comes a week after protesters were arrested for not taking down their pro-Palestinian tent encampment on campus. The Northeastern commencement will be held at Fenway Park. Meantime, restaurants are expecting a bump in business during graduation season. Massachusetts Restaurant Organization President Stephen Clark says establishments have a lot to offer.
It's an opportunity not only for the specific, you know, graduation dinner, but a lot of times people are traveling in to the state and spending a couple days here. So there's multiple opportunities for breakfasts, for dinners, for lunches.
Clark says he does expect restaurants in Boston and Cambridge to be especially busy. 3,500 people are due to take part in Project Bread's 56th annual Walk for Hunger tomorrow. The organization hopes to raise $1.3 million this year. Project Bread President and CEO Erin McAleer says one in five families in Massachusetts is food insecure.
That means we all know somebody right now who is struggling to put food on the table. And it's also important to know that that rate, that 20%, that's what it was during the peak of the pandemic when we were in lockdown and people were out of work.
In-person participants will be walking a three-mile loop around Boston Common. Other walkers will take part remotely. Senators Ed Markey and Elizabeth Warren are calling on the U.S. Bureau of Prisons to end solitary confinement at all of its facilities. In a letter to Attorney General Merrick Garland, they point to a recent federal report showing the Bureau's use of solitary confinement is widespread and discriminates based on race. The City of Boston and the MBTA are starting to work on the redesign of a stretch of the Green Line. The aim is to redesign the stretch of the E Branch along Huntington and South Huntington Avenues. That is the only part of the line where the trains travel alongside cars. The Red Sox lost to the Twins 3-1 in Minneapolis today. 50 degrees at 5:06.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow. We're starting the show with a look at the third week of former President Donald Trump's criminal hush money trial. It ended on Friday with a high-profile witness, Hope Hicks. For years, Hicks was a trusted member of Trump's inner circle. She told jurors about what happened behind the scenes in Trump's 2016 presidential campaign when the unearthed Access Hollywood tapes seemed to upend the race about a month before Election Day. That's the tape many will remember where Trump was recorded bragging about grabbing women's genitals. Other key witnesses this week included the lawyer who negotiated the alleged hush money payments for Stormy Daniels and another woman that Trump allegedly had an affair with. And I spoke about this week's testimony with NPR political reporter Jimena Bustillo, as well as Tristan Snell, the former New York prosecutor who led the state's case against Trump University. I started by asking Snell why that moment of panic in the Trump campaign when the Access Hollywood tape surfaced was so important to the criminal case.
The criminal case really hinges on what exactly was the motive or the incentive or the purpose behind the actions that were taken. The documents are going to be pretty clear that, of course, payments were made and that then Cohen was reimbursed for them via falsified invoices. The question is why? Falsifying documents is a misdemeanor. Falsifying documents to cover up another crime is a felony. So it really comes down to why did they do it? The context is king here. And that's why so much hinges on the timing and the overall context of what was going on in October of 2016, just after the Access Hollywood tape and on the eve of the election. Showing that panic is really, really key to the prosecution being able to say, this was for politics, this was for the campaign, this was not to hide it from Melania.
What did you think the defense was trying to do when they were cross-examining Hope Hicks on Friday?
They're really trying to show distance between the story that we know we're going to get from Cohen and what other stories they can try to create or manufacture here regarding what Trump was doing. Namely, they're going to try to show, the defense is going to try to show that Cohen somehow acted alone, that he had gone rogue, that he had determined himself that this was a good idea for Trump's campaign, that Trump didn't direct him to engage in the payment to Stormy Daniels, and that he had basically done this on his of his own volition and independently of anybody else. I don't really think that they succeeded in that. The fact that Hicks now is under oath on the record saying that she didn't really believe Trump telling her that is, I think, very compelling. That Hicks's opinion of Cohen is that he would not have done anything like that just because he felt like it was a good idea. He would have wanted to take credit for it and so forth and so on. I think that Hicks's testimony is going to be a buttress supporting Cohen's upcoming testimony.
Mm-hmm. So that was the most high-profile witness this week coming in at the end of the week. Jimena, who were the other key witnesses that we heard from?
Well, the other main key witness was Keith Davidson, and he was the former lawyer for Stormy Daniels, the adult film star, and Karen McDougal, the former Playboy model. Both received payments from Cohen and the National Enquirer magazine, respectively. And Davidson was the lawyer that negotiated these payments and these contracts in order to sell the rights to their stories so that they wouldn't get out. On the other half of this coin was the catch-and-kill scheme that was created between the National Enquirer, Cohen, and Trump to find these stories and buy those rights so that they wouldn't get out. And so we heard from Davidson about how these payments were negotiated. We looked at some of the contracts. And then we also looked at a lot of text messages between him, leadership at the National Enquirer, and he talked about conversations that he'd even had with Cohen related to these payments.
Can you tell us about the what have we done moment that came up in the text messages from election night in 2016 when Trump has been elected president?
Yeah. So Davidson says that he didn't do these deals to help Trump win, but he knew that their actions would benefit the campaign. And on election night 2016, he texted Dylan Howard, the editor of the National Enquirer, that they were working with to close this payment deal. And he texted him, "What have we done?" And that was kind of a bit of an alluding to what have we done to help Trump win. That was a point on election night when it looked like Trump was winning enough delegates to, you know, secure the official role. And Dylan Howard just texted back, "Oh my God." And so there are a couple of texts like that that do come out. There was another one where Davidson jokes about waiting for his ambassadorship at the White House, you know, and kind of things like that indicate that they knew that this would benefit the campaign in one way or another.
Tristan, what to you were the most important angles that the prosecution focused on with Davidson? And same question with the cross-examination from the defense.
I think that the key takeaways from Davidson's testimony were just, it was additional foundation laying for what is to come with Cohen. It's, again, corroborating Cohen's account of all of this. Davidson was in direct contact with Cohen throughout this whole time period. That's really the key takeaway from all of this. We have not seen a lot of fireworks from witnesses like Davidson. I think that the less flashy these witnesses are, the more believable they're going to be. I don't really think that the cross-examination of Davidson really accounted for all that much. They're trying to make some of these people out to be self-interested, but I don't really think that's going to resonate much with the jury. I think the jury's common sense will kick in to say, look, this is not exactly a savory business that we're finding out about here. Nobody looks terrific in any of these situations. This was all a rather shady set of transactions. And only by getting into this kind of set of witnesses and transactions will we actually get to the truth.
Tristan Snell, Jimena Bustillo, thanks to both of you. May the 4th be with you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You can hear the full conversation to get the latest news from the ongoing New York case by downloading NPR's Trump's Trials podcast. There are a lot of questions that hang over the ongoing Israel-Hamas war in Gaza, and among them, what comes next for Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu? He's facing increasing pressure from both around the world and from voters at home. NPR's Peter Kenyon reports.
In some parts of the world, the impact of the war on Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's political fortunes may be an open question. But analysts say inside Israel, most voters have made up their minds.
Let me put it this way. I don't think he's going to survive October 7th.
Alan Pincus is a former ambassador and foreign policy advisor to four Israeli foreign ministers. He says people could be forgiven for wondering how Netanyahu could still be on his political feet, given the events of the past several months. He says Israeli coalition politics have something to do with it.
And he's kept above water only because, A, he does not have the decency or the moral composure to resign. And B, more practically, because there is a coalition that wants to survive, and their survival depends on maintaining the coalition. So he's maintained within that coalition.
But Pincus says Netanyahu will be held responsible for a military operation that has not achieved any significant strategic goal. He says Hamas has not been neutralized, much of the Gaza Strip is in ruins with an apparent massive civilian death toll. He also thinks Netanyahu has done substantial damage to Israel's reputation, even with its closest allies.
He has mismanaged relations with the U.S. He has turned a justified and justifiable war in the aftermath of October 7th within a few short weeks into complete hostility, animosity, and criticism of Israel worldwide.
Lawrence Friedman, Emeritus Professor of War Studies at King's College London, says few would dispute that Israel had to answer the Hamas attack of October 7th. But at this point, questions about when it will end are on the rise.
Netanyahu's got a problem. How he brings this to an end? What point can he say we've done what we need to do and it's now time to hand over Gaza to some authority that can run the place?
Friedman also says considering that Netanyahu faces serious corruption charges and there have been massive public demonstrations calling for him to step down, it's not surprising to hear critics say he doesn't want to see this conflict end for some time to come.
And there is a view that he's not particularly keen for that moment to come, because when that moment comes, then the issue of his own position and possible elections becomes moot.
For his part, Netanyahu says if reports that the International Criminal Court in The Hague may issue arrest warrants for senior Israeli officials are true, it would be an outrage of historic proportions.
And in targeting Israel, the ICC would be targeting all democracies, because it would be undermining their inherent right to defend themselves against savage terrorism and wanton aggression.
In a column for the generally conservative Jerusalem Post, Deputy Editor-in-Chief Tamar Ariel-Berry said that the government should bring about elections with the understanding that the Israeli people have lost all hope and trust in their government. Political analyst Dalia Shendlin says currently Netanyahu appears to have enough support to hang on to his job. But even were he to leave office, she says it's not clear his main rival, security hawk Benny Gantz, would make major policy changes.
It's unlikely he would manage this war significantly differently. I imagine the biggest difference is that he would try to conform to international expectations, that there is a clear set of criteria for when the war will end and how.
For the moment, the biggest choices facing Netanyahu include whether to prioritize a hostage deal with Hamas or launch the long-promised military incursion into Rafah in the southern Gaza Strip. Peter Kenyon, NPR News.
Listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
WBUR supporters include The Huntington with Toni Stone, Play Ball, the remarkable true story of the first woman to play professional baseball on a man's team, shattering expectations and setting her own rules. Lydia R. Diamond's script is filled with humor and love of the game. Opening May 17th at the Huntington Theater, huntingtontheater.org.
WBUR occasionally offers you the opportunity to win prizes in conjunction with our fundraising efforts. Complete rules are at WBUR.org. 49 degrees at 518. This is All Things Considered.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Zoo New England. Zoo what makes you happy at Franklin Park Zoo and Stone Zoo. Learn, explore, discover, and more. Learn more at ZooNewEngland.org. And Lauren Holleran with Gibson Sotheby's International Realty in Cambridge, real estate brokerage that is grounded in data and committed to thoughtful design, laurenholleran.com.
I'm Janine Herbst with these headlines. A delegation of Hamas is in Cairo to discuss the latest proposal to end the war in Gaza. It's according to Egyptian state media. International negotiators say after a number of failed attempts, there are signs of a potential compromise for a ceasefire. In Houston, hundreds of people have been rescued from homes, rooftops, and roads as high water flooded neighborhoods around the city today following heavy rains. The National Weather Service issued a flood watch through tomorrow afternoon. And in Brazil, at least 39 people are dead, dozens missing, after heavy rains led to record flooding in the southernmost state of Rio Grande do Sul. The thousands were forced to flee their homes, cell and internet services out in the area. I'm Janine Herbst, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Made in Cookware. Made in Cookware is crafted by chefs for chefs and designed for restaurants and home kitchens around the world. Their cookware can be found at madeincookware.com. From Linda Mood Bell Learning Centers, summer instruction for students to catch up or get ahead. Live online or in-person instruction for reading, comprehension, and math. lindamoodbell.com/NPR. And from ECMC Foundation at ecmcfoundation.org.
All Things Considered from NPR News, I'm Scott Detrow. Today marks the 150th running of the Kentucky Derby at the Churchill Downs Racetrack. Feathered and flowered extravagant derby hats are on display. Thousands and thousands and thousands of mint juleps are being sipped.
It's chilly and gray at Churchill Downs after a rainy night. But as they say, nothing can dampen the enthusiasm of the Great Kentucky Derby.
The race itself only lasts around 2 minutes, but the tradition runs deep in America.
We've had two world wars, a depression, pandemics. We've always run a Kentucky Derby.
That's Derby Museum curator Chris Goodlett in an interview with CBS News. A few days ago, excitement ramped up as post positions were assigned to the horses in this year's race. The last horse to be called?
Number 13.
13, West Saratoga.
Harry Verrucci credits veteran horseman Larry DeMeritt for finding West Saratoga.
Trainer Larry DeMeritt is in his 70s, and this will be his first ever Kentucky Derby. Born in the Bahamas, DeMeritt will be the first trainer from the Caribbean to participate in the Derby, and just the first black trainer to do so since 1989. Black trainers, jockeys, and grooms are a rarity at the Derby these days. That wasn't always the case.
The first Kentucky Derby was in 1875, and Oliver Lewis, an African-American, won the first Kentucky Derby. And that particular horse was trained by Ansel Williamson, who was African-American himself.
That's Ronald Mack, founder of the Legacy Equine Academy, in a Kentucky educational television documentary about the history of black horsemen.
In that particular race, 13 of the 15 jockeys were black jockeys. 15 of the first 28 Derby winners were black jockeys. And so there was dominance and prominence in the industry.
Black people played a key role in the history of the Kentucky Derby, but there hasn't been a black trainer in the Derby for decades. Today, trainer Larry DeMeritt changed that. I spoke to him earlier in the week as he was getting ready for the Derby. Well, Larry DeMeritt, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you for having me on.
There's been so much of a focus on the milestones here, especially the fact that it's the first time in decades that a black trainer has a horse in the race. But I want to start with the milestone for you. This is your first ever Derby after such a long career. How are you feeling?
Yeah, I'm feeling great. I'm excited. You know, we all have different style running, different ways of getting them ready to this race. But the ultimate goal is who gets there first. And I'm confident in the horse I'm taking there. I won't trade him for any other in the race.
When did you first start working with horses?
Before I know myself. My dad was a horse trainer, and he put me on the horses back when I was pretty young. So, like I said, I know them before I know myself. And I know I wanted to be in the horse industry. So I look at it this way. I said, well, I don't want to be a jock because their career don't last long. I know I'm not going to be just a worker. So I had to be a horse trainer because I could do that till I die.
And are you at Churchill Downs right now? Where are you as we talk?
As we speak, I'm heading home from Churchill Downs. I was there from about 6 o'clock this morning. Got home late last night.
I imagine there's a lot of, you know, you've got the feelings of being here. You have a horse in the Derby, but also you've got a lot of work to do to get ready for race day.
Yes. You know, it's all paying attention to detail. And you don't want to miss something or leave any stone unturned. So it's just staying there and stay focused. And that's the key, is the smallest thing can make a difference in a horse, getting there or not, you know?
Can you tell us more about the horse's personality? What's West Saratoga like?
Oh, man, he's a jewel. He's a jewel. He's such a cool horse. He loves the camera. He likes to stand up on the pose when you're taking a picture. He doesn't get rattled at all. I haven't seen this horse rattled since the time I had it.
Mm-hmm.
Just a layback horse, carry good flesh, eat well. That's what makes him so special.
I want to ask you about some of the broader trends that people have been focusing on when it comes to your participation in the race. And the first is your personal story. You've been battling cancer for a long time, 3 separate diagnoses over the years. How are you feeling physically, and how much are you thinking about the odds that you've personally beaten to get to this point this week?
Yeah, I don't look at it like that I beat the odds, you know. I am a person of faith, and, you know, I had a friend, a good close friend I lost to cancer. And I told him, I said, you know, Kojo, everybody pray for you to get well. I said, I don't pray that prayer. I pray for you that God is not true with you yet, because when your work is finished on this earth, you're going to go home. So that's the way I look at my life, you know. So I feel like I'm here for a purpose, and I think this is my purpose, the opportunity to make a difference in someone's life, but either battling cancer or someone with a young kid would need to be encouraged and believe that anything is possible, but you have to work at it, you know. Mm-hmm. That's the way I look at life. And, you know, the funniest thing right now, although I have the cancer, that is not the main issue what bothers me. It's the other disease I have, amyloidosis. Mm-hmm. That's the one what really beats me up right now.
Yeah.
But I still never let that stop me from being focused on the task at hand.
I mean, I imagine that makes it tougher, but I'm glad you're still able to do the job, and it seems like a physically demanding job. Yeah.
My job ain't tough. Then you do things you love. It's nothing is tough about it. Mm-hmm. Get that smile put on your face when you see a horse train good that morning for you. You know, and that's the good thing in Saratoga. You don't have too many bad days.
Yeah. And I want to ask about something that's also gotten a lot of attention. You're the first Black trainer since 1989 to participate in the Kentucky Derby. And before 1989, there hadn't been one since 1951. So this is a once every few decades occurrence. Why do you think so few Black people are in positions of prominence in this sport, especially given its historic heritage?
That's a good question, and could be a hard question, too, because it's more reason than one.
Yeah.
Number one, we don't have enough Blacks in it to begin with.
Yeah.
Because a lot of Blacks that has the finances could afford it. Either they don't know the game or they don't want to get into it. And I don't look at it like that. I don't like even make talk about the races, the race stuff, because the way I look at it, all of my clients are white, so I can't make this a Black and white issue. You know, I just thank for the opportunity to do this, but I don't think we should make it that, hey, this guy got a Black bond, I need to be in his bond. Now, I want people in my bond because they believe in my ability to train a horse.
So you were talking about, on the question of Black trainers, you said that a lot of people might just not have the financial resources. Do you think there's anything big picture that the racing world can do to kind of open the doors to this sport to more people, given the hurdles that there are?
Yes, I think so. I think for one thing is we need to sell our sport better than we do. The game has come down to now where we need to form more syndicates because it gets pretty costly now to own a racehorse. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like any other sports car, racing and all of them, they all have syndicates where so much sponsors, you know, a car. I feel like that's what we have to do to let the middle class know in America that it's not a sport of kings. Anyone could play it, and the reward is so great when you have success in it.
It's Larry DeMeritt. He trained West Saratoga, who's running in the 150th Kentucky Derby. Larry, thank you so much.
Okay, thank you for having me. And anytime you all want to, after I win the Derby, you can call me.
Non-citizen voting has emerged as a flashpoint this election year. Republicans, including former President Trump, want to crack down on non-citizens voting in federal elections, even though that is already illegal. Some jurisdictions do allow non-citizens to vote in local elections, though. As Michaela Lefrak with Vermont Public reports, turnout is low and local leaders are trying to figure out why.
In the municipal offices for Winooski, Vermont, population 8,000, City Clerk Jenny Willingham clicks open a file with data from the last local election in March.
1,345 people participated in our annual city and school election. 11 of those ballots cast were from our all-resident voting.
Winooski is one of three Vermont cities where non-U.S. citizens can vote locally. Willingham says getting those 11 non-citizens to vote took a lot of legwork.
I did the ballots in 12 languages this year and had four interpreters there. Burmese, Nepali, Swahili, and Somali.
Burlington, the state's largest city, counted 62 votes by non-citizens, less than half of 1% of the nearly 15,000 votes cast. And in Montpelier, the state capital...
What have I got? I've got 3, 4, 5, 6, 7...
That's John Odom, Montpelier's city clerk.
8.
Counting their 18 registered non-citizen voters. There's so few of them that he keeps their paperwork in a half-inch blue binder.
Yeah, not a whole lot happening on that front in Montpelier, but we're still very proud of it, of course.
This trend extends outside Vermont. Tacoma Park, Maryland, legalized local non-citizen voting 30 years ago. Still, registration and turnout remain relatively low. There are grassroots efforts in Vermont to increase voter participation among green card holders, refugees, and asylum seekers. The city of Burlington pays outreach workers to connect with immigrant communities. Jules Wetchy is part of that program. He's from the Democratic Republic of Congo. He hosts local radio and TV shows where he talks about voting and other topics for French-speaking new Americans.
And I did what they call civic education, to push people to know how they should be engaged to vote, because it's very important. This is our second country, so we are living here. We should be more engaged to the political situation.
But Wetchy says there is some fear. People have told him they're afraid they might get harassed when they vote, or it might mess with their citizenship application, even if their city clerk assures them that it won't. Some of that fear stems from the national spotlight on this issue, which got brighter last month. That's when former President Donald Trump and House Speaker Mike Johnson pushed legislation aimed at stopping non-citizens from voting in federal elections, which is already illegal. Vermont Secretary of State Sarah Copeland Hansis, a Democrat, says she understands why some Vermonters are reluctant to have their names on a publicly available list of non-U.S. citizens.
We are a nation of immigrants, so it's wild to imagine how we got to this place where we have to worry about these things.
Winooski and Montpelier were sued by the state and national Republican parties to try and stop local non-citizen voting. The lawsuits were thrown out. But Copeland Hansis wonders if they added to the chilling effect.
Because I'm quite certain that there are more folks who would have been eligible to vote in those local elections.
In Washington, D.C., Republicans in Congress are trying to block a law allowing non-citizens to vote locally. The law went into effect in January, and 372 non-citizens are registered in a city with around 450,000 total registered voters. There's a lot of pressure on local officials. They know that one slip-up, like a presidential ballot being mailed to a non-citizen, could end up on the national news. Larger jurisdictions, like D.C., have voter databases that track non-citizen voters. Vermont doesn't yet. Winooski City Clerk Jenny Willingham keeps her non-citizen voter registrations in a beige filing cabinet.
All right, so you have, like, manila folders and filing
cabinet.
Manila
folders and a filing cabinet.
Despite the low turnout, non-citizen voting means a lot to many Vermont immigrants. Jules Wetchy says his mom recently made the move to Vermont. She only speaks Swahili and a local dialect, but he hopes she can vote one day.
Because her voice is very important. Her voice can change many things.
The thing is, Wetchy and his family just moved to the city of South Burlington, which doesn't have non-citizen voting. His mom can't vote there. But he can. He's a full citizen. He's even thinking about running for office one day. For NPR News, I'm Michaela Lafrak in Burlington.
¶¶
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. We saw major changes this week in one of the largest Protestant groups in the U.S. when the United Methodist Church voted to end its condemnation of homosexuality. Bishop Tracy Smith Malone chairs the Council of Bishops. She recalled the words of Methodist founder John Wesley in describing the decision.
Although we cannot think alike, may we not love alike? Mm-hmm. May we not be of one heart, though we are not of one opinion?
United Methodists made a raft of other decisions around LGBTQ inclusivity at the church's general conference meeting in Charlotte, North Carolina. And joining us to discuss them is NPR religion correspondent Jason DeRose. Hey, Jason.
Hello.
So let's start with those additional major changes. Tell us about them.
Well, delegates removed from the denomination's rulebook a line added in 1972 that said homosexuality is incompatible with Christian teaching. The church removed punishments for ministers who officiate at same-sex weddings. It broadened its definition of marriage to include two people of consenting age rather than restricting marriage to one man and one woman. And it lifted bans on LGBTQ clergy.
Let's talk response here, because some United Methodists have been working toward these changes for decades. What are they saying about this?
Well, as you can imagine, they were elated, singing hymns and cheering on the meeting floor there in Charlotte. Reverend Effie McAvoy is a queer woman who leads Hope Methodist Church in Hope, Rhode Island.
When professed in churches that folk are beloved of God, the queer child, the gay child, the parents of a queer, gay, or transgender child will not sit in the pew and wonder, well, are they saying that to my child too?
McAvoy says these changes are proof the church is living into the phrase, all are welcome.
And United Methodist Church has lost about a quarter of its congregations, mostly traditionalists, in recent years because of these fights over queer inclusion. But I'm wondering, how are the conservatives who remain in the church responding to this news?
Well, even among many who hold more traditionalist understandings of sexuality and marriage, and there are a lot of them, there was consensus and a desire to move on. Reverend John Stevens is pastor at Chapelwood Methodist Church in Houston, Texas.
I think that we can live together as the church. We can be in unity together. We can be in mission together, even though there are going to be not maybe just this. There will be other things that we will disagree on.
These changes don't require any minister to perform a same-sex wedding or any congregation to allow one.
You've been describing this as a joyous meeting, and that has not been the case at a lot of previous Methodist assemblies that address these issues. What do you think changed?
Well, one big difference is the departure of the most conservative congregations over the last several years. Many of them saw these changes on the horizon and left. But more importantly is this. The United Methodist Church is a global denomination with congregations not only in North America, but also Europe, Africa, and Asia. One of the other major decisions at this general conference was something called regionalization, which essentially broke the church into large geographic regions that can make their own rules around ministry and marriage. So while the global bans on LGBTQ clergy and same-sex weddings have been lifted, those could be reimposed in specific places, such as Africa, where United Methodists are mostly far more conservative than here in the U.S.
That's NPR religion correspondent Jason DeRose. Jason, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
This is NPR News.
And we thank you for spending your weekend or part of it with 90.9 WBUR and for listening every day. The latest news is at the top of every hour. Wait begins at 10 tomorrow morning. Keep listening. I'm Susan Levy. In about 20 minutes at 6, stay with us for the Moth Radio Hour. It runs until 8. 49 degrees at 5:39. This is All Things Considered. Stay with us.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by BU School of Social Work, top-ranked part-time MSW programs in Bedford, Fall River, Worcester, and Cape Cod. BU.edu/SSW. And the ART with Gatsby. From the theater that brought you Waitress and Jagged Little Pill comes the world premiere musical. Starts May 23rd, amrep.org. And Russell's Garden Center with unique Mother's Day gifts.
flowers, plants, wind chimes, statuary, hummingbird feeders, sun hats, cards, and more. Russell's, Route 20 Wayland.
I'm Janine Herbst with these headlines. The Republican National Committee is holding its spring retreat in South Florida this weekend, and some of the events will take place at former President Donald Trump's Mar-a-Lago estate. He spent most of the week in a New York courtroom for his criminal hush money trial. Part of I-95 in Norwalk, Connecticut will be closed this weekend as crews make repairs after a fiery crash between a car and two tanker trucks, one of which was carrying 1,000 gallons of fuel. Officials hope to get it open by Monday. And health insurer Aetna has agreed to settle a lawsuit over whether its fertility treatment coverage discriminates against LGBTQ plus patients. A federal judge still has to approve the deal. I'm Janine Herbst, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the University at Buffalo. The University at Buffalo is developing new AI technologies with the goal of solving some of society's most pressing challenges. More at buffalo.edu/AI. From Progressive Insurance, with its Name Your Price tool, a way to see coverage options based on a driver's budget. Learn more at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Price and coverage match limited by state law. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow. You've probably heard about Marfa, Texas. And if you haven't, it's a small town in the middle of the West Texas desert known for its art. Maybe you've read a Vogue article about it. Maybe you know the art there. Maybe you've seen countless Instagram pictures of people standing in front of Prada Marfa. Marfa is a town with a lot of hype, and it's a huge destination for tourists. But there are different realities when you actually live in that town full time. Enter Marfa for Beginners from Marfa Public Radio. It's a podcast that calls itself a tourism podcast for locals. It aims to highlight different myths and realities people experience living in Marfa. Joining me now to talk about the podcast is Elise Pebble. She's the host and executive producer of it. Hey there.
Hey, Scott. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. Let's start with this. Why did you want to make this podcast?
So, you know, as a person living in Marfa, the things that stand out to me about this place are different than maybe what you would read about. Marfa is not just an art town. There's more to it. It's the fact that a Virgin of Guadalupe apparition appeared on a pecan tree. It's how hard and beautiful it can be to find love. It's the psychological realities that only exist when you live in a small town, like, you know, paranoia, claustrophobia, or a sense that time has disappeared.
I feel like a lot of the things you mentioned here can certainly apply to people who don't live in Marfa.
Yeah, exactly. Ultimately, what we're trying to do here is tell universal stories. We're saying you've got to know that a backyard is not just a backyard. It's a pilgrimage site. You got to know what it's like to try to find love in the middle of nowhere. You got to know about the 6-foot-tall, larger-than-life woman. And yes, these stories are based in Marfa, but I think they resonate no matter where you are.
All right. Well, let's do a little bit of it.
Okay. The first stop, finding love in a hopeless place. Something people always ask about is, what is it like to date here? The truth is that finding love in West Texas can feel impossible. You swipe right 3 times and nothing. People in cities can download a dating app and scroll basically forever. But when you live in Marfa, you actually reach the end of Tinder in 5 seconds.
It's sad. It's a really shallow pool that everyone has dipped their toes in.
If your signal is going to be like searching out into the ether, it's going to be completely people that you know, and it will be like 7 people.
Yeah, mine said like 100-mile radius. Here, it gets a little desperate. Marfa, it's like a perfect case study for like a lot of social topics, you know? And I feel like for dating, Marfa just puts it right there where you can see the hopelessness of dating globally. Yes, I've dated in my hometown in Juarez. Yes, LA, New York, Virginia, Dallas. It was the same. It's just here, it's so small, you're vulnerable, you're really exposed and raw. It magnifies it.
Say goodbye to the one you love.
When you break up, you're like, you need to not exist. You know, you need to like cease to exist and, you know, like who gets what, you know? I will get the Capri. You take Lost Horse, you know. I'll also take, you know, like all the cultural events. If you want the Lannan readings, you can have them. You know how you separate the goods. They will be your server or cook your food or, it's terrible. Again, yeah, Marfa magnifies the struggle of the breakup.
There's no space. There's no escape.
I love the image of dividing up a small town like it's like a custody dispute between like you get this area, I get this area. That feels, I mean, I feel like people in larger communities can certainly relate, but it can certainly like understand how pressing this issue is when it's so small, when you just know you're going to see each other.
It's so true. That is a perfect example, Scott. But it's not all hopeless, I have to say.
Okay.
Scarcity can also lead to some unbelievable love stories. In a town that's so small, everyone notices new people, especially when there are a bunch of them at once. Namely, 10 handsome dudes who magically appeared in 2018, a group of builders called the Enablers.
Now, the word enabler makes you think of somebody who's doing something bad for you, like you're an alcoholic and they're bringing you tequila, but it's nothing like that. They enable the construction to happen. That's why they're called the Enablers.
They all came from Austin to work on this really long-term project.
It would take 3 years to build this enormous home with this very difficult substance to work with.
I was working at my friend's restaurant and they would come in on their lunch break. I mean, I obviously noticed them. You can really feel and see when new people come to town. They seemed very kind and cool and hardworking.
These are like the most handsome, ripped, great-looking guys you ever saw in your life.
And basically, these nice guys all partnered up, and there were weddings and babies.
Well, there you go. Not all negative. Some positivity, too. Obviously, dating and the pros and cons is a big part of a community like this. But we mentioned early on the idea of the passage of time and how sometimes it just feels different in a smaller community. That's another thing you look at, right?
Yes. Scott, our producer Zoe became obsessed with this gigantic clock that's being built by a foundation called the Long Now in a mountain a couple hours outside of town. It's called the 10,000-year clock because it's supposed to last that long.
Did you know that Jeffrey Bezos is building a giant clock inside a mountain and it lasts 10,000 years?
Yeah, and it's being built by Jeff Bezos.
I have a lot of questions about this, and I'm hoping you can answer them.
So, okay, basically the clock is insane. But it really captivated Zoe because the clock is supposed to make some big, important statement about time. But as someone living in Marfa, her actual experience of time in a small town in the middle of the desert is totally baffling. Time feels like it's passing super slowly in the moment, but years then also pass in the blink of an eye. I know this might sound familiar, Scott. Like, we all look at our lives and say, what happened? Time passed so quickly. But that's not exactly what I mean here. In Marfa, it feels different. It feels like being on another planet, at the edge of time. And it all starts with the drive into town.
It seems impossible that any time is passing at all. Your car wheels might be moving, but you are not. And then you arrive in Marfa. I've left and moved back to Marfa 3 times, and every time I return, it feels like it's just the way I left it, preserved in amber, like an old movie set, an empty stage.
So Zoe explored this in multiple ways and built this truly interesting and beautiful audio version of an existential crisis featuring a geologist, an astronomer,
and a guy named Mark Whitman.
I love a good existential crisis. Let's listen.
Mark is a German time psychologist, and I called him because I can learn about rocks and stars, but I'm still having an experience of stagnancy. Like, nothing is happening, even when things are definitely happening.
So you have some sort of, time paradox you're experiencing. You're talking about two different time perspectives, yeah, or time orientations, and one is the passage of time at the moment as it passes now, maybe, huh? And the other is the retrospective time perspective, in the sense that you're looking back, say, the last week or the last 6 months. Yeah?
He explained that when you experience the same thing over and over and over again, and nothing really changes in your environment, your brain doesn't actually store a new memory, because what would be the point of remembering the same thing? It's like accidentally taking a burst photo on your phone that captures 37 photos of the same thing when you didn't even mean to take a photo in the first place.
Part of small town life is being attuned to these specific realities. And there are things that we want to show you about Marfa and this experience of living here. Some of that, when you travel to Marfa, is about people. And for us, it's really about one person in particular named Liz Rogers. Marfa is a place that can feel cool and aloof.
Yeah.
But Liz is the total opposite. She's warm and generous and wants to know you, whoever you are and wherever you're coming from. And I want to be transparent, Scott. Sometimes that coolness and aloofness really frustrates me. And I wanted our podcast to share a counterweight.
Liz loves human beings, and she likes to collect them, and she likes to have them at her dinner table, and she likes to drink a little beer with them. She likes.
Liz's friend Robert is kind of the unofficial MC of this party.
And that's a really fabulous way to be. And it's irresistibly attractive, like a... My grandfather used to have a saying, that girl's like a porch light to a June bug, and I think that's true about Liz, right? That she just, you're not sure why you're sitting at her table, but there you are.
And what we want to demonstrate with that living eulogy is, you know, there's a way that Liz lives that's a lesson to all of us. It's about how to embrace the magic and adventure in life.
Elise Pebble, host and executive producer of Marfa for Beginners. Thank you for joining us.
It's a delight to be here.
I like to run. I've also got young kids, and the combination of the two can be tricky for a lot of parents. It can be hard to find the time or the energy or the elusive magical combination of both to go get that run in when there's always so much to do. And that is where the running stroller comes in. Now, some parent runners hate them, some love them, but no parent in world history has done what Caitlin Donner recently pulled off. The 34-year-old mother of two and her 20-month-old son, Mikey, just set the world record for running the mile while pushing a stroller, a blistering 5 minutes and 11 seconds. That topped the previous record by 13 seconds, and the Guinness Book of World Records was there to make it official. Caitlin Donner joins us now to talk about this. Caitlin, welcome to All Things Considered.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. I'm excited.
You're a world record holder. How's that feel?
It's really fun. You know, when I had my son, the one that was in the stroller, and then even my older son 5 years ago, didn't expect that this was ever going to be on the radar, but it's turned out to be a really fun experience.
How did this first come about? Were you doing any other races with stroller running? Were you just running with a stroller and thinking, what if? Like, where did this come from?
Yeah, it was not on my radar at all. And one of my best friends, who's the director of operations of Space Coast Runners, which is a local nonprofit running club here in Melbourne, Florida. She pitched to me shortly after Mikey was born in 2022. Hey, there's this, you know, Guinness Book of World Records stroller mile. Maybe you should think about it. We've been going back and forth with it, and I've been kind of joking with it, like, ah, I don't know. This seems, you know, kind of silly, and not silly in the sense of like to take away from parents pushing a stroller at all, but you're pushing a stroller in a circle around a track 4 times. She convinced me about 2 weeks before the event, hey, I'm putting on this 4x4 mixed relay as part of the club. What do you think about doing the stroller mile at the beginning? And I knew she wasn't going to let it go, so just said yes.
How much specific training went in? Were you doing loops on the track with the stroller beforehand?
I did one workout with the stroller on the track. So a couple days before, like 3 days before, I went to the track and just did four 400s with Mikey in the stroller. So I've run plenty of miles pushing the single stroller, pushing the double stroller, and then have trained for a lot of different race distances, you know, along the way. So you just kind of keep running, and I just wanted to get a feel for the turns on the track.
Mm-hmm. I think it's probably clear to anybody listening that you are a serious runner. You've been a competitive runner for a while. Can you fill us in on the background of what you were doing before you were the world record holder in stroller running the mile?
Yeah, so it's not completely out of nowhere. I ran at University of Florida on a track and field scholarship and cross-country scholarship for 3 years for the 1500 meters and transitioned over to triathlon, was on the U.S. national team for several years on the ITU circuit trying to qualify for the Olympics and was in two Olympic selection events, but unfortunately didn't make the team. And then after my first son was born, kind of transitioned away from triathlon. I didn't want to travel quite as much and have that living out of a suitcase lifestyle. I wanted to be home more. So opened up a PT practice and then just started running more. I think running is a lot easier in the sense of you can put on your shoes and just go out the door and do it, as opposed to triathlon where you're swimming, biking, and running. So there is an athletic background. I didn't just decide to pick up the stroller and go run around in circles. but it's been really fun.
What was Mikey's mindset during the record run? Was he competitive about it? Was he staying still, or was he just like, hey, we're going fast, this is fun?
Yeah, apparently he was looking around after about 200 meters. I kind of saw his feet go up and I was like, oh no, because he's definitely my wild child. Like, he's definitely a second child.
Yeah.
And when we take him on bike rides, when he's in the bike seat behind me, it's 50-50 whether he keeps his helmet on. So he did great. He only had to last, you know, a little over 5 minutes, which is a lot shorter than a lot of our runs. And he got to have fun with his grandparents and brother as soon as we got done.
You know, I do have one last serious question, though. This is probably striking a lot of parents, because a lot of parents, when they've got young kids, are really intimidated about getting back into exercise. You know, you're exhausted. If you gave birth, there's the physical recovery. A lot of this is really daunting. Do you have any advice for somebody listening with young kids thinking, it is so hard to exercise, I could not even run a 12-minute mile right now?
It's funny you bring this up, because I was just talking with one of my running partners this morning, because this is one of the most asked questions that I get.
Yeah.
You know, what I really want to say to people is, like, I don't know, I'm figuring it out along the way, like a lot of most parents, that you can continue to do hard things and work for big goals. Definitely prioritize yourself. There's really always mom guilt, I think, on almost any run I'm on, or even doing the stroller mile or taking them to different races. It's like, you're like, what is this for if I get them up early or they're up late? But at the end of the day, they do have a lot of fun with it. They like spending time with me.